Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. On our show today, digital assets. Sure, we all have social media accounts and documents stored online, but I would bet none of us have included those digital assets in our estate plan. We'll talk about why it might make sense and how to do it. And walking a fine line on financial literacy. When it comes to the banks, there's a risk of conflict of interest, given that they make some of their money based on our bad behavior. Credit card debt. So, what role should the banks be playing? We'll talk to the incoming president of the Canadian Bankers Association. Then, success through storytelling. We'll look at how sharing personal stories can improve financial outcomes. Plus, veteran personal finance columnist John Chevereau on his book, Victory Lap Retirement. Let's get started. When it comes to estate planning, the list of things to think about is already long. Well, it's getting longer now that Canadians have amassed so-called digital assets. Keith Masterman is Vice President, Tax, Retirement, and Estate Planning at CI Investments. He joins us now to talk about what they are and how you should account for them. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
Digital assets. What are you talking about when you talk about digital assets?
Basically, digital assets are everything that you have that's online. So your Gmail account, your Bitcoin account, any gaming things that you might have online, all of those things are your digital assets.
Those crazy photos from high school that I wish would disappear, but
Bingo,
are on Facebook forever.
Your Facebook, your LinkedIn, all of those things are your digital assets.
What about loyalty points? Are those considered digital assets?
They are. They are digital assets, and there has to be special planning about those in your estate plan.
You wrote a piece for advisors.ca. One of the things you highlighted was a Deloitte statistic that estimated Canadians have about $1,000 worth of digital assets, which doesn't seem like a lot to me. Is this worth worrying about if it's only $1,000?
Well, I think there's a few things to remember. One of them is that that's $1,000 to $2,000 today. The belief is that by 10 years, we'll have about $10,000 each. But it's more than the monetary value that makes a huge difference about these things. There's a lot of sentimental value. I always tell people when they're putting their estate plan together, and an estate plan is not just your will, it's your power of attorney. But when they're putting an estate plan together, make sure your family can still have Thanksgiving dinner together after you pass away. These assets have huge sentimental value, and they can destroy a family after you pass away. Mm. The other aspects I think that are important are not only is there the monetary value and the sentimental value, but there's also the ease at which you're allowing your executor or your representative to remove your identity from the net. You know, a statistic that's kind of interesting is 20 Canadians every minute are a victim of personality fraud or personality theft. When you stop monitoring your online personality, that statistic is a lot harder to monitor because it's so much easier for people to steal your personality.
And if you're no longer living, it's kind of impossible to monitor it unless you have a plan B. What are some things that should be specified in an actual will? What does that look like?
Well, I think the big issue for online assets or digital assets is the fact that if you want people to actually have access to those assets, you have to spell it out. So all the photographs you have online, do you want your family to be able to...
Only the flattering ones.
Exactly. Some of those college things you did, you might not want those photographs. But if you don't have specific instructions in your estate plan, the presumption by most of the providers of those plans is that they can't be shared by anyone. So they're just going to be lost. So, you know, one interesting thing is the modern Facebook is not only the modern photo album, but it's also the modern diary of people. Mm. All of that will indeed be lost when you die if you don't have instructions in your will. So specific instructions of what you want done with these assets.
How do we manage passwords in an estate plan? Because, a lot of people have the craziest password rules that would be impossible for an executor to figure out if they didn't have a cheat sheet. How do you address that?
So I think the first thing is to make sure that there's a good list of all your online assets. And once you've made that list, it's a really good idea to have a list somewhere of your password protected, of a website that's password protected that your executor can get into that has all your passwords. Because you're right, there's nothing worse than putting the right estate plan in place and then not having your executor have the ability to somehow find your passwords and log on to it.
How do you see clients that you work with distribute these assets to heirs? Because, you know, with furniture, Marge gets the Tom Thompson and Betty gets the, you know, Chippendale table. Who gets my Facebook profile?
I find that quite often it's just simply left to the family to break it up. Quite often the will have instructions that say, I'm allowing my executor to obtain access to these assets, but leaving it to the executor's authority to work with the family to break up the assets. A lot of these assets are duplications. So photographs you can duplicate and have a copy for everyone. Same with your online diary or your emails. Those can be duplicated. The harder issues are the actual assets with monetary values. Who gets access to that? We find that quite often the air miles go to the next of kin, being the spouse. And then the rest of the assets basically are liquidated and distributed to all family members.
Do we have some cases where things have gone wrong in this area? I mean, I'm sure this will be relevant for my generation, but as someone in my 40s, I've still got many decades before this is relevant for people who pass away long before average life expectancy. These issues are real and resonant right now.
Yeah, most of the case law is American case law. But it really, really resonates with Canadians when they're putting their estate plan together. And if I may, I'd like to mention two cases to you. One of them was the case of Sahar Dafari. She was a model, and she was actually the Face of Asia contest winner. She was 23 years old when she died. She fell off a balcony in her boyfriend's apartment. There was a huge dispute about whether or not she committed suicide, whether it was an accident, or whether she was killed. Her parents certainly took the position that she'd been killed. There was a grand jury in California that wanted to get access to her online diary, her Facebook, etc., because they felt there would be things about who she feared, her concerns, her state of mind at the time. Facebook got a court order opposing the subpoena asking for their information, because Facebook takes the position that if they had disclosed information, even with an order by the court, they had breached her right to privacy. Unless they saw something in her will saying her executor or her representative had the right to that information, they took the position that information couldn't be released.
And where did it net out?
Facebook never did release the information.
They never did. Okay. Yeah. Now, I understand Facebook's approach is different than Google's. How do they differ?
Well, this is the issue, right? You have to look at each individual provider and find out what the contract you entered said. So every single time you enter one of these things, you're going to click a button, and that button's going to have a contract.
And I am never going to read that contract.
Exactly.
Do you read that contract?
Never.
Never.
Never. And I mean, it's sort of an odd contract because you have no ability to negotiate. You only have an ability to press yes, accept it. Facebook will not disclose. I believe Gmail will provide a disk with some of the information on. The other case, just out of interest, that I wanted to mention to you, and you know, maybe I'm flogging a dead horse here with case law, was the Stetson decision, which came from Wisconsin. And in that case, a young boy committed suicide. He was in his early 20s, I believe. He might have been in his late teens. His family wanted to access Facebook because he didn't leave a suicide note, and they really wanted, as part of their healing process, to understand why their son did this. Mm. Again, they wrote to all his online providers, and again, they had the same issue that people said, I'm sorry, unless there's something in his will, his power of attorney, whatever there is, we can't release this. In that particular case, the family got a court order requiring Facebook to disclose, and Facebook still took the position that they were too worried about privacy legislation and delayed in providing the information.
What's the bottom line for you as it relates to digital assets and estate planning?
Yeah, I think there's four points that are really important. One, make an inventory of all your digital assets. Your executor won't know what they are. So it's really important that your executor, or in case of a power of attorney, knows where they are. The second thing is appoint someone who's knowledgeable about these types of assets when you look at your estate plan. That might mean you have an executor or a power of attorney for one purpose, and then a different one for these digital assets.
A 22-year-old for the digital assets.
Yeah, there you
probably
go. Exactly. The third thing is make sure things that if you have things password protected, there is a list somewhere that allows your executor to get a hold of that list. And the last thing is put detailed instructions in your estate plan. Make sure that your executor knows what you want. Even if your will has a general clause that says, I want to make sure that my executor has access to these things, I authorize my executor to have access to these things, leave instructions for your executor somewhere, or you're going to make sure your family can't have Thanksgiving right. dinner together after you die.
Wow. Keith, thank you very much for the cautionary tale. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Keith Masterman is Vice President, Tax, Retirement, and Estate Planning at CI Investments. Well, coming up later on Moolala, saving for retirement is one thing, living in retirement is another. We'll hear from John Chevreau about his new book, Victory Lap Retirement. But next, financial literacy and the financial services industry. It can be a little complicated. We'll talk to the president of the Canadian Bankers Association about how the two can come together. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry on Facebook. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
This is Moolah Law, Money Made Simple on Sirius XM. I'm Bruce Ellery. There are a lot of reasons why the big banks should be behind improving financial literacy for Canadians, but there are also some reasons why maybe they shouldn't be. We're going to look at the potential conflicts of interest and some potential solutions. Neil Parmenter is the president and CEO of the Canadian Bankers Association, and he joins us now. Hello there.
Hi there, Bruce.
You spent your entire career in communications, most recently as the chief communications officer at TD Bank. What are some of the differences that you notice now that you're outside of the bank itself, but in an organization that represents the banks?
Well, there are huge differences. I mean, at the Canadian Bankers Association, we represent 64 banks. So people think of my job as working with the big five banks, but I actually work with 64 banks coast to coast. That's both domestic, the large ones, the smaller domestics, and then the foreign banks.
Most important question I can ask at this point is, how many kids growing up in your family? Do you have experience dealing with this?
I have two.
Two. So you're one of three?
Oh, sorry.
No, when you were a kid.
When I was a kid, I'm an only child.
You're an only child.
Yeah.
Wow. Maybe that gives you a refreshing perspective on that, because I feel like I'm the youngest of five kids. I would have been very well prepared for squabbling amongst 64 member nations.
I'm sure you probably were. Yeah.
I was. Now, Canadian banks, they are strong, they are powerful, and they are profitable. When it comes to financial literacy, you could say, to whom much is given, much is expected.
Absolutely.
What is the role for the banks when it comes to financial literacy?
Well, I mean, the truth is, financial literacy is one of those terms that, I don't love, notwithstanding the fact
that— We share that. We have that in common.
Notwithstanding the fact I sit on the National Steering Committee for Financial Literacy. And the reason really is that it's binary, right? It denotes you're either literate or illiterate.
Right.
And I view financial education is just that. It's a journey, and it should start when you're a child, and it should continue your entire life, right? Past post-retirement, I think there's still opportunity to learn. So I think the banks, in answer to your question, have a huge role to play in not only providing information, but arming customers with the right questions to ask to continue that education journey.
We're going to talk about some conflicts, as I foreshadowed, but at CBA, you've got two demographics that you've been doing some work in the area of, seniors and high school students.
Yes.
Let's start with the students. What's the program? How does it work?
It's a seminar, and it's a non-commercial seminar, so it's given on a volunteer basis by bankers from across the country. And so what would happen is a teacher or a principal school board would request a seminar, and it's really aimed at 15-year-olds, but it's designed to give them the 101 in terms of budgeting, how to spot and be cognizant of fraud, particularly debit card fraud, and then a little bit on the responsible use of credit.
Mm. You have a 13-year-old, not quite 15, but 13.
I do.
One of the things that I think is going to be really important for me as a parent getting to that age is addressing peer pressure, because so much of the consumption, sure, it comes from social media and advertising and all that stuff, but it also comes from the kids sitting next to you in history class saying, oh, yeah, this is what I have. What do you have? How do you think that fits within a financial literacy context?
Well, I think it's critical, and this is one of the things that, you know, when I talk about financial education, I think we have to look at those things in totality. I think often we look at, we'll just provide more information and more resources, but I think you can scan, you know, pick a bank, pick the CBA, the FCAC, there's a variety of government agencies that have all kinds of information on there, but I think what is perhaps an area for improvement is to address what you're talking about, which is a real life situation. You mentioned my 13-year-old, and to be sure, she's the spender. I have two girls. She's the spender and a saver.
You already have noticed the temperament difference.
Absolutely. Since they were very young, one of the things I've offered both my girls is that, you know, when you get that $10 birthday money, if you deposit that money or whatever you deposit in a bank account, in a savings account, I'll double.
You'll double it.
I'll double it. And
where does one get those kinds of returns? That's even better than an RESP.
And what I've noticed is my young one, if she gets $10 worth of birthday money from her grandparents, she will scour the house for loose change to turn the $10 into $10.50 or $11. And she wants the $11 doubled, not the $10. At best, my eldest will take her $10 and spend at least $8 of it, and I'm doubling $2 and $3 and $4.
Really? So your younger one's going to be trading commodities by the time she's 15.
Well, my joke is she's going to be the landlord, and she's definitely the strict one. If the rent money's not there on the first, it'll be out on the street.
I hope she cuts you some slack on your rent when you're a senior.
So do I.
Students are one big demographic. The other is seniors.
Yes.
And this is relevant for the seniors themselves, of course, but it's also relevant for my generation, Gen Xers, who are seeing our smart, capable, wonderful parents aging into a phase of life in which they're less, you know, they're less focused on some of these logistical things for a bunch of reasons.
Absolutely. And that's really the design of the program. It's a newer program for us at the Canadian Bankers Association. But to your point, many seniors have lived their entire lives one way, which is, you know, they want to buy that first home, they got their mortgage, then they want to pay down the debt, and they're saving for retirement. And they've got, in terms of cash flow, they've got that paycheck or whatever it is, and everything is by and large steady year after year after year. And all of a sudden, all the dynamics change when they retire, and perhaps they're having to, you know, they're on more of a fixed income or they're on a different income source. And they're facing different challenges. A big part of the program that we have for seniors is to highlight what's an unfortunate problem in Canada, one that we think, if left unaddressed, will continue to grow, and that's elder financial abuse.
Mm-hmm.
That's whether they be a victim of fraud from fraudsters, but sometimes, frankly, can even be friends or family taking advantage of people.
And there's a fairly, nebulous definition of what fraud actually means when it's family members, in that there can be a tacit agreement that I'm the one who takes care of mom, so therefore I get some money for gas money, or I get $1,000 a month for providing those services. It's not like the huckster who knocks on the door and steals $100 from her purse.
Yeah, exactly. You've just captured it. And really, you know, I know a big theme, and what I think is so great about shows like this one is getting people to talk about something that is inherently personal. And perhaps if we talk about different generations in particular, they might be uncomfortable with. But it's important. As you said, when there are these unwritten rules about I do this and as a result I get this payment or I get access to this, that's where families, you know, resentment can grow. You mentioned siblings.
Yeah.
And that's an obvious place. So I think the more that can be done to actually encourage people to have a conversation and be open and honest with one another, I think the better. I think when things are hidden, when there's not light on them, that's where resentment can grow. And frankly, unfortunately, people can be taken advantage of.
How do you factor in cognitive decline? And that isn't to reinforce the stereotype that seniors are starting to lose it. But there is a difference in the hardware for someone who's 80 or 90 years old than there is for someone who's 30 or 40.
Absolutely. And it's a very fair point. I think when you look at powers of attorney, when you look at options that need to be documented with a financial planner, I think those are the sorts of conversations that need to happen. And again, I think what you want to do is start off with a plan, but also give yourself some degree of flexibility to understand that circumstances might change. You know, health can change, not only mental health, but physical health as well. And to ensure that people are protected, both for their own sake, but ultimately for their families as well.
We've talked about some of the easy areas when it comes to financial literacy. And when I say easy, I mean there's no conflict. Let's teach our kids stuff. Let's take care of our seniors and arm them in the risk of abuse and fraud. But there are some areas that are more difficult to talk about when it comes to financial literacy, given the competing interests of the individual and the institutions. What are some of those areas that leap to mind, where they're just like, oh, how do we navigate that?
Well, I think, you know, it can often happen in areas like credit, where there's you know, how do you ensure, I think when some people hear the word financial literacy, we already talked about how I'm not a big fan of that term, but I think when some people hear financial literacy, what they really think is marketing. They think you're trying to get in front of people, whether they be youth or other groups, and entice them to dependency on credit or other financial products. And I think that's a legitimate concern. It's something that needs to be watched. It's certainly something that we take quite seriously at the CBA. But I think that's often where there can be some inherent conflicts is are you truly helping them understand how to build effective credit and use it appropriately, or are you just sort of luring them to a product?
I've used this example before, but if I think about the two Bruces that there could be the Bruce who's financial education guy, and he wants everyone to pay off their credit card in full every single month, no matter what. There could be a Bruce who held the P&L responsibility at a big bank for that particular part of the lending portfolio, who, provided the defaults aren't horrific, wants Canadians to carry a balance. And the last number I saw was an outstanding balance of somewhere around $3,000 or something like that. How do you true those two things? How do you bring those two things together? Because they're diametrically opposed.
Yep.
If every single Canadian paid off their credit card, that would be bad for the banks.
Well, I think, you know, starting off, as you said, there's about 60% of Canadians pay off their credit card debt in full every month. And so that obviously means there's about 40% or so that aren't. I think I hear the argument, and certainly that's a concern for people. I think what you look at in terms of most banks is they're taking a holistic approach to their relationship with the customer. And if your objective is product by product to take advantage of a customer, you're ultimately not going to be in a good place in terms of your overall relationship with the customer. And so I think some might argue that's a cynical view. I certainly understand why people could draw that conclusion. I tend to view that as a cynical view. But I do think that, by and large, most banks are interested in the total financial health of their customer. Look, banks aren't in the business of lending money. They don't think they're going to be paid back. And particularly as it pertains to credit cards, which is an unsecured product, there is greater risk with that, so they're going to want to ensure that customers are
it's paid back, because it's only $3,000. It's not a big deal, and people who carry a $3,000 balance have a pretty good credit score. So it's not a risk of default. It's more that they're earning money on the interest on that outstanding balance, which if we took a pure financial education approach, we'd have people eliminate overnight. And, you know, on your website, there actually isn't anything about the problems of credit cards. There's the stats that you talked about, the benefits for consumers, the benefits for retailers. But from an education standpoint, there isn't anything that says, here are the numbers. If you carry $3,000 for an entire year, here's what it costs you. And if you just were able to pay that off, that would be so much more beneficial to you.
Yeah, I think you've seen, and there's been some real enhancements over the years in terms of credit card statements, in terms of making clear to customers what the true costs are in terms of carrying a balance and what the alternatives are and how long it would take to pay off the balance if you were to only pay the monthly minimum. So is there work to be done? Are there areas for improvement? Surely. But I think directionally things are going the right way in terms of responsible use of credit by Canadians.
Here's another tough area is mortgage affordability. So when you do the calculation or you talk to any lender, whether it's a bank or a mortgage broker, and you talk about the affordability question, really what they're answering is how much can you afford without defaulting? Because we think about, not to say that they don't love their customers and all that stuff, but they don't spend an enormous amount of time talking to the client about all the other things that may require cash from that person over the course of their life. They come into the house of affordability through very different doors. How do you reconcile that?
Again, I think what's a huge opportunity for banks, and you're starting to see them make some pretty big inroads in doing it, is this concept of advice. And again, in your words, taking a total picture of the customer's obligations and ensuring that housing affordability meets a test, not that's a pass-fail binary once again, but taken in concert with all of the other obligations you have. Is this a payment you'd be comfortable making? And I think that lenders have a responsibility to play in that, as do the borrowers.
The CBA has been engaged in financial literacy from a measurement perspective. You've got an evaluation tool trying to test the efficacy of some of these programs out there. What have you found from that early work?
We, again, it is very early, and we've done some great work with Prosper Canada and the FCAC on this front. It really starts with trying to get a more common understanding about what success looks like and a common sense set of metrics for people to evaluate their financial literacy tools programs. But we're early in that process, and I think we're expecting to see a lot more results by the end of this year.
Neil Parmenter is the president and CEO of the Canadian Bankers Association. The focus of our conversation is financial literacy. And one of the real challenges, I think, is the Canadians' perception of the banks, which you were at TD when a particular set of stories came out from the CBC about sales practices at the bank. What kind of hit did the banks take in terms of trust?
You know, I think much of the evidence that I saw in terms of overall reputational risk surveys and pollings show that the impact wasn't as great as you might expect. That certainly there was a fair amount of noise, particularly concentrated in a small number of media outlets. But at the end of the day, and if you talk to our members, both large and small, they tell you the same thing, that the allegations made in many of those media accounts weren't reflective of the reality at the institutions themselves.
Why aren't in-branch employees called sales consultants? And I asked because, so as that story was unfolding in Canada, I went into my local telecom store to get a new bloody phone, and I was all set. I knew I was going to be sold because that's, you know, I had to go get a new phone. So there was a new contract. And the person's name tag said sales consultant. Given the focus on selling, which I don't think is a bad thing, by the way, but given the focus on selling in a branch, why not call them sales consultants?
You know, I think you're going to run the gamut bank to bank, and so it's difficult to give an industry perspective on those. I know some still call their frontline employees tellers. Others don't. They're
financial services representatives.
They have a variety. So it's difficult to have sort of an industry standardization on that. And it really does change bank to bank.
What do you think, where do you think the trade-offs need to be made on some of these conflicts that I've highlighted? If it's mortgage affordability, if it's the fee discussion on mutual funds, if it's credit cards, what are the trade-offs?
You know, it's difficult for me with a great deal of precision to sort of say, you know, it should be this, it should be that. I think what's most important is that you take a holistic view of the customer beginning to end, from the banking side to whatever products they have, if they have a wealth relationship. And that anytime you're looking at your relationship with a customer solely based on a product set, that's not serving the customer well and ultimately not serving the bank well.
How do you approach the growth of fintech in Canada, which I know is an enormous topic? We could talk about it for days.
I'd love to do that for days.
Yeah. But if we were talking to Terry Campbell or Nancy or Ray Prati or any of your predecessors a decade ago, fintech was not a word. We wouldn't have talked about it. It just would not have been on the radar in any respect. This is going to be a huge challenge for your members in the future.
And I also say a huge opportunity.
Yeah.
I think years ago, the narrative on fintech was, you know, they're the ultimate disruptors. They're going to come in and they're going to eat the bank's lunch, and they're going to take over. I'd say in general, what fintech does exceptionally well is solve customer pain points. And if you think about other industries where technology's moved in a disruptive way, that's what they've done. They've solved a pain point for a customer, whether it's how I pay or how I order a service or where it's available. As it pertains to banking, what they often lack, it starts with trust. So it's usually a brand new name, a new brand. And so there's no relationship of trust, which is ultimately what banking is all about. And there's certainly not often extensive balance sheets, fraud management, liquidity, risk management programs. And those are the things banks bring. And so I think where you've seen fintech be most powerful and most successful, and I expect will be the trend that will continue, is where fintech and banks partner and bring new capability and new services to customers. And the customers ultimately get the best of both worlds. They get the customer experience they want, but they know that the bank is ultimately there in terms of its strength and solid balance sheet.
There's one factor you didn't mention about consumers. We're so lazy. We're so lazy. So if I can get kind of the service that I get at my current institution, I may not go to a fintech because I'm too darn lazy. I have one last question for you. Canadian banks are profitable. They have a strong reputation globally. What would you say are the top three priorities for you at the CBA? Now, you should have been prepared for this question in your job interview. So I think it shouldn't be new.
I did okay, I guess.
Got the job.
Without doubt, and we just talked on it, is that much of the legislative framework governing the banks was written decades ago and was based on the premise of ink and paper and physical pieces of plastic in the forms of identification that you need to show up to a branch to fulfill whatever purchases or new products you want. And so I think, you know, sometimes people say, you know, the banks need to innovate. I want to be able to do this all on my mobile phone. I want to be able to do it digitally. The technology exists today, that will exist today. What doesn't exist is the legal framework to actually be able to do some of those things. So that's number one on my agenda. I'd say number two, and in a related vein, is cybersecurity is a big area of concern for the banks. And so if you are going to move things more digitally, and we talked about the importance of trust, you need to ensure that consumers can remain assured that their information is going to be kept secure. I'd say the third one really is we're in the midst of a payments modernization program that Payments Canada is leading, which is really exciting, but is also quite ambitious in terms of how we move money, what capabilities will exist, who will govern it, who has voting rights over those things. And so payments modernization will be another key priority for me.
Neil, best of luck.
Thank you very much.
You have signed up for a big, crazy job.
I have, but I'm excited about it.
Okay, that's good. Neil Parmenter is the president and CEO of the Canadian Bankers Association. Coming up, Victory Lap Retirement. What is it and how can you do it yourself? But first, the power of storytelling. Monica DuPont on how to use personal stories to help people get a better handle on their money. I've written a couple of books, and there's some stories in there about people doing great things. You can order them online. First is called Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
One of the challenges many people face in getting a handle on their money is a lack of confidence. Confidence in their skills, confidence in their willpower, confidence that they can actually change their lot in life. One of the ways to build confidence is to listen to stories about other people who have walked a similar path and been successful. Monica DuPont is the founder of Strive, and one of the things she's working on is gathering and presenting some of those stories. She joins us now. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
Why are stories so important?
I think they're really important. I think they provide real insights into how people approach their money. They speak to the journey. We often look at others who seem to be doing well financially, and we see the external cues, right? So we see the dinners or the trips or the nice clothing, but we don't really know their savings account. We don't know their credit card balance. We don't know how stressed they are about retirement or how comfortable they are. And so stories really provide a perspective and an understanding of the behind-the-scenes look.
Yeah.
They're really important because they help understand how people have navigated there, what have been the costs to getting there, what decisions have been made, and why people made the decisions they made.
On the Strive site, you've got many, many examples, and I want to go through a couple of them. First off, Rohan. Someone who was new to Canada, had an education, but still had many hurdles in his way to overcome. So tell us a bit about his story.
Yeah. So Rohan's a really great story. He came to Canada. He pursued his master's here. So he's educated in Canada. And he was really interested in the field of social entrepreneurship. And this is a new field, right? So he's creating employment for himself. So entrepreneurship is hard in any area. You're juggling lots of balls. You have lots of hats. It's a lot of foundation building. And so with Rohan, he was dedicating his resources to that. He's married. He has a new child. And so his brain is at full capacity. He really had not spent a lot of time figuring out his finances. And so he had credit card debt of $30,000. And he'd gone to the bank and he'd asked for better options. But because he was an entrepreneur, so he didn't have a stable income, and because he was new to the country, didn't have credit, he really couldn't get much beyond the high interest rates of credit cards. And so he was told no, and so he just focused on building his business. And so he actually, I met him, he came to one of my earlier workshops. And through some discussions, we talked about the need to push the banks and to go back and find a different manager or find a different bank. So he did that, and he was able to get a lower credit card. So still credit card, but lower interest rates. And then he also qualified for a loan product from Borrowell, which had lower rates.
What do you think are some of the lessons that a reader would take away from that story?
I think from that story, there is the most important lesson for me is the need to problem solve on an issue. So if you're told no, and it's still a big issue, you have to find another solution. So you can't just ignore it and continue working on other kind of revenue sources or other challenges that you have, because that's not going away. So he was paying minimum payments at over 19%.
Wow.
He could increase his business income significantly. He still needed to deal with that problem. And so figuring out how to bang your head towards a solution is really important.
One of the populations that you work with Strive are people who are dealing with a whole bunch of circumstances that Rohan wouldn't have. Maybe it's job loss or mental health issues or, a lack of education that presents them with fewer job opportunities. How do you include or be a catalyst for problem solving for people with so many other hurdles to hop over? Mm-hmm. And maybe not the intellectual experience or I'm not sure what the word is, to actually problem solve in that way.
Yeah, I think the first thing for problem solving is understanding where you want to go. So, I've read all your Mulala stuff, and it's very much around live the life you want to live, right? So where does someone want to go? And when you know where you want to go, you can start to think about how to get there. What are the different paths of opportunity? So Patricia, another individual in one of the stories, she was an artist. She studied art, and she recognized that wasn't a very highly paying field. And so she wanted to be more stable. She maneuvered towards interior design. But she didn't. It wasn't easy to get a job. So she set up a system where she emailed a bunch of firms and offered 10 weeks of free internship. So she did that. That was how she broke in. But her first salary was $27,000, and she had to move back home to do that. Mm. And she's now maneuvered towards between $80,000 and $100,000, and put down a down payment for a house. But that took a lot of work. Right. So when individuals are in lower income echelons, they have to understand what the big barriers are and how they can maneuver. So for her, it was finding a job within her field and building a career there. So I just need to get one. I'm going to work for free for 10 weeks as a way to do that. Right. So that got her to the next step.
These stories that we're talking about live on your site, but you also integrate them into the workshops that you run. How does that work?
Mm-hmm. So the workshops are they're an offline way for people to engage. And the value of peer-to-peer engagement, or let's say facilitated peer-to-peer engagement, is that you get to understand the tactics that others have used, what's worked, what hasn't. There's as much learning in the failures as there is in the successes. There's no reason that we should repeat another's failure, right? So individuals get to share those stories, and it also creates a sense of I'm not alone. So it creates a community of individuals kind of working towards their goals and a sense of accountability. So we set goals at the end of each session and kind of recap them and try to set up mechanisms to reinforce behaviors of resiliency.
Sometimes stories don't have a happy ending. I don't know if you know, but Disney does not actually run the world. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, I think, it's really important. Happy endings aren't always there in finance, and it's a long journey. So you could have someone who has millions of dollars in equity and loses it. Right. And you can have someone who struggles financially and builds up a lower economic but yet stable life that they are happy with. I think what's important is to be really respectful and to try to extract the learnings from everyone's journey so that we could share and value that journey for what it is and use it to help others so that we can increase the overall success.
These stories are at
www.letsstrive.ca.
Let's Strive. Monica, thank you for coming in and talking to us about it.
Thank you, Bruce.
Monica DuPont is the founder of Strive. Coming up next, retirement can be an exciting, fun, awesome next chapter. veteran personal finance columnist John Chevreau will be here to talk about his book, Victory Lap Retirement. And Monica DuPont answers the Moolala questionnaire. You can subscribe to the podcast version of the show on iTunes, or you can head on over to moolala.ca to download whole episodes or individual segments. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The key to a happy retirement may be not retiring. That's the message on the book Victory Lap Retirement, co-authored by Mike Drack and Jonathan Chevreau. Chevreau is the former editor of Money Sense Magazine, also was around the Financial Post for a very long time. He is our guest. Hey, John.
Thanks for having me.
I was going to say a really long time at the Financial Post, but we don't want to put, what, almost two decades, right?
Almost two. And I still write for them freelance, as I do for Money Sense. And
you practice what you preach here. You have officially retired from Money Sense, but you're still working. How's it going?
Well, I'm having a great time. I mean, I'm going to be 64 in April, so, and I'd always said, you know, if I'm going to be a retirement expert, I should probably sort of retire at least by,
right,
not 65, because everybody does that,
right.
So 64 one year earlier. So it's basically, we call it, you know, some people would call it semi-retirement. It's probably what it is. Anybody who's freelance knows about the life.
One of the phrases you use is turning a paycheck into a playcheck. What does that mean?
It's a good line, but I must admit Mike wrote that particular line. It really comes in the context of travel. Or, I mean, you're a speaker, so you know if somebody sends you to, you know, Halifax or New York, and they're paying the freight and the hotel and all the rest of
I'm ordering room service if they're paying the freight.
Yeah, exactly. So that's really a play check. I mean, I never visited Newfoundland till last summer, and you know, some clients flew us down, so. And you may only earn half a paycheck, and you may have to pay for the spouse. But as long as somebody's defraying some of the costs, like my wife works in the transportation industry. We've been to Taiwan and Hong Kong and just most recently in Ireland and Dublin. Nice. You know, so that's earning a paycheck.
One of the things that struck me was a study you referenced from Shell Canada that talks about early retirement and what may happen to you if you retire early. The findings from that study were not particularly appealing for those who retired around age 55. Why don't you tell us about what that study was and what inference people could draw?
I can't speak directly to that, but I do know some of the studies we looked at, like the people who retire before 65 is not good for your long-term health. I mean, we all know about longevity. There's a book called The 100-Year Life, and it talks about the millennials in particular, which the book also addresses. So I think almost every second of them are going to hit age 100. I have a friend that goes to church with, and she just turned 100, and believe it or not, she still works a half day a week in a local printing shop.
Wow.
And I'd say it was not because she's not working because she's living longer. I'd say she's living longer because she's still working. She's I want to get out of the office, out of the apartment.
Right, and feel like I'm contributing in some way.
Yeah, exactly. And same, and you know, for us journalist types, I mean, that goes double. I mean, like you get so used to absorbing information and then spewing it out in another form. It's like hard to break that habit.
Some of the millennials will say, and they say this with good reason, given the cost of real estate and the challenge it is for them to say, but they'll say, I can't save for retirement. I'm just going to work until I die. That may be the same end result as victory lap retirement, but with a very different context.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, the plan of working for till you die has two problems. One, you may not find a willing employer or clients to indulge your habit. And second, your health could fail. So we don't say you don't have to save for retirement because you're going to work forever. We still think, in fact, the subtitle of the book is The Joy of Financial Independence at Any Age. We're all for FinDependence, as we call it. In your 30s, if you can, get rid of the mortgage, get rid of your credit card debt, et cetera. But it's all about having the freedom and flexibility that not having to make the mortgage payments confers that allows you to now sort of be a little more picky in your spot. And like, really, it's about achieving your true dreams. Rather than sort of making, well, I think a lot of people make a lot of compromises. They raise a family. I'll do this. You know, I want to be an editor, but I really want to be a writer. Or I'm a journalist, but I really want to be a novelist. All this kind of thing. And so that's what Victory Lap Retirement is.
What are some of the key steps to taking advantage of this idea? Because you write, victory laps don't just happen. So what are the steps to make them happen?
Well, it's a facet of financial planning, but I think it's also almost, you almost advocate going to a life coach. It's not just about the money side of retirement, so-called retirement. It's about purpose and meaning, et cetera. And just like in financial planning, you need to plan for it. There is a big financial element. If you're still employed and you're sort of thinking, I would like to do a kind of an encore career. I want to, you know, I don't like my boss, whatever. I don't like the meetings, the 9-to-5 regime. You should ideally plan for it 2 or 3 years out. And, you know, as we joke in the book, maybe you don't tell your boss until maybe the last 6 months. But then you do want to, because ideally, an employer is your first client, your big client, and then you go find a second and third client out there, right? So you want to leave on good terms with your current relationship. I mean, I'm still working with both Money Sense and Financial Post,
right?
Even though I don't work there, you know, day by day anymore.
You've some ideas on how to find these gigs. So one is the continuation of work that you have done for former employees. The other one you had is monetizing a hobby. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, it could be anything. For example,
because my dad would like to monetize his golf game.
Yeah,
now he'd be very interested in that.
Well, he could get. I know a retiree actually does have a summer job at a golf course. In Peterborough, I remember in the summer, there's a lot of ex-teachers, and you go to these arts and crafts festivals, and you find them at these booths. They're either selling art that they used to do as a part-time, they're selling them for $500, $1,000, or pottery or ceramics, whatever it is. So there, they may have had a hobby, and we all know teachers have wonderful pension plans, but they still need the meaning, and they might have a little extra money, and so they make their art. So there's a hobby that got monetized. There's many examples. I mean, the millennials call it a side hustle.
A side hustle. I like it. Now, how do you recommend people boundary time? Because I can see for some people, they say, yeah, I'm going to hang up my shingle. I'm going to consult. And suddenly I have 10 clients and I'm working as hard as I did before. This is not the victory lap retirement that just feels like my boring old work life all over again.
Yeah. Well, you have 2 hours a day more if you're working from home. It's true that paid vacations are a little harder to come by. This is why you need to try to be smart about it, find a gig that actually they pay you to go somewhere. So you come. That's why we say work while you play, play while you work. So that's the key, I think. You know, have some financial independence and be smart about the gigs that you take. So try to integrate your work life with your play life. So if you love and are passionate about something, you can't really tell whether it's work or play. Mm. This distinction between work and play is part of this thing about commuting to a physical office,
right,
where you have all these strange people called colleagues and bosses, and at the end of the day, you're released for another day.
What do you think the gap is that Victory Lap fills, the book fills? What were you trying to say that hadn't been said?
I think there was this myth that you have to have a ton of money, for like millions of dollars, in order to retire and do nothing. So the biggest myth is people think they want to do nothing.
Right.
Because they've spent 30 or 40 years being stressed out in corporate settings. What they may just need is a sabbatical, go back to school and retrain. And so the Victory Lap is just a chance to recharge and find out what they really want to do. And once they're recharged in a new field with more challenges, they may find that they didn't want to retire, they just wanted to change. And that's what Victory Lap is.
How did your sort of social environment evolve after you left full-time work? Because that's one of the things that also plays out in the research, is people who are actively engaged in their community in some way, work, play, you know, religion, volunteering, whatever, can make a huge, is a huge benefit to health and well-being.
Yeah, I don't miss the one-hour commute to Sherbourne and Bloor.
Right.
We have a lovely house right by Lake Ontario, and I do a lot of walking. But I go to yoga 3 times a week. I've just resumed playing hockey. I go to Toastmasters. There's a lot of things. You need to, when we're on your own, you need to make sure you're interacting with fellow human beings. Otherwise, you know, it's going to be just such a thrill when the postman shows up at 10:30, because that's your human interaction until your spouse comes back at the end of the day. So you got to get out there. Yeah. But the business world naturally provides all sorts of things. You're going downtown for seminars, and you're having meetings, and you're having lunches. And so I talk about the four-hour day in the book, and that's part of what we talk about.
John Chevreau is the co-author of Victory Lap Retirement. John, thanks for your time today and for coming in. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. This is a series of questions about money, little bit about life. Our guest, Monica DuPont, is the founder of Strive, an organization focused on creating an economic and socially thriving society. So, Monica, the first thing that comes to your mind, you ready?
Mm-hmm.
You ready? Here's the first question. How would you describe your money personality?
Oh, my money personality. I think I am... I see money as a safety blanket, so I'm not driven by it as long as I have enough to do the stuff that I love to do.
What is like, some of the stuff that, on your love-to-do list?
My love-to-do list?
Yeah.
I love to travel. I like to work on stuff that I find intellectually challenging and socially beneficial, so I'm a bit of a geek that way. So having enough comfort to be able to maneuver my career and not be as concerned about salary has been really important to me.
If you were to name a guilty spending pleasure, what would it be?
Food. Yeah.
Truffle oil. Truffle oil, I don't know, duck confit. What would be like, give me something specific. Give me the item of choice. When you go, you're like, this is, we're spending on this one.
Oh,
Monfuku.
Okay. Oh, I have a good friend who's the chef at Dai Lo, and it's really good.
Right.
It's really, like, yeah, it's just really, really tasty. It just melts in your mouth.
Really,
it's worth every
spending.
Penny. Yeah.
When do you plan to retire, and what will you do?
You know, I like working. So I think for me, retirement will be a reduction in the hours that I work, and we'll have lots of travel. So I would still do work because I like it. I'm a freelance consultant, so I would probably, I don't know, try to move to like 20 hours a week and then travel.
What has been your worst financial mistake in your lifetime?
Oh, boy, my worst financial mistake. You know, I think I kind of look at it that there aren't mistakes, because if you learn from them, you can build on it. So I've made a ton of mistakes. Recently, there was water damage in my basement. And so I called a guy in and he told me it was the drain. So I believed him. I'd had three quotes to come and do the first set of the first inspection. And it wasn't the drain. So that was $3,000.
Oh,
I know.
Yeah. If you landed a huge financial windfall, and I'm calling $25 million a huge financial windfall, what would you do with it?
I'd share it with family and friends. We'd go for good food and maybe buy.
You should buy a restaurant for $25 million.
That's a lot of work. I don't want to do it.
But maybe you've been down that path before.
My husband has.
Yeah. You know it well.
I know it well. Maybe buy like some property for friends and family who don't have it, and then figure out how to donate it or use it in an effective manner for those who don't benefit from that.
What is one money topic you could write about, talk about, hang out and yak with people about every single day and never get tired of it?
I think for me, it's resiliency. So it's not necessarily building lots of money, but it's how to build mechanisms to be resilient, so to weather the ups and downs. Mm. And I think that's one of the most important things about money, is being able to, if you lose your job or if you separate or if you have some family member that's in need, you can weather that storm. So you have pockets of and kind of little safety blankets to weather it.
What is one topic you wish you never, ever, ever, ever had to talk about, write about, think about ever again when it comes to personal finance?
It would be like budget calculators.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. The number, yeah.
Okay, if you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be?
Oh, it would be a move from thinking about the short term to thinking about the long term, and like what kind of life you would like and how the decision of today is contributing to that.
That's worth a snap. There's a snap. Yeah. Monica, thank you very much.
Monica
DuPont is the founder of Strive. That is our program for today. Thank you for joining us. To listen to past episodes, head on over to iTunes or to moolala.ca. You can subscribe to the next podcast on iTunes, or you can go and listen to shows or segments as you'd like. Please send us your questions to ask@moolala.ca, moolala.ca, at Bruce Celery on Twitter, Facebook, Bruce Celery, Moolala is how to reach me there. Thanks for listening and have a great day.